Hi, I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of January 18th, 2013.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
A lot of us are starting the new year with an old problem, the flu. This year's flu season not only began earlier than usual, it's being called one of the worst in decades. Staying healthy can feel like a losing battle, especially if you're surrounded by sneezing, sniffling coworkers. Luckily, the doctor is in. Dr. Russell Greenfield joins us now to talk about some of the harsh realities and myths of flu season. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
So I keep seeing in the news that this is one of the nastiest flu seasons ever. What's going on? Is this the bug from hell?
You know, it is in some ways. Unfortunately, the type of virus that's causing the flu this year is called the H3N2 virus. And it's notoriously a very, very harsh virus, and it causes a very rapid spread of a very difficult and really hazardous disease. Way, way different than the common cold, and it really knocks people for a loop.
What's the difference between the flu and the cold?
Well, anybody who's had the flu knows the difference. The cold is a hassle. You know, you can get sniffles, runny eyes, you can get cough, you can have congestion, but it's the kind of thing that you can live with and usually get by. But the flu comes on fast. You've got fever, body aches, headaches. You feel horrible.
I'm sorry. Now, our producers took life in limb by going out on the street and talking to potentially infected people about the flu. We were surprised to learn that a lot of people don't get a flu shot, despite news reports that there are plenty of flu vaccines available. For example, here's Oscar Mota from Pico Rivera.
I don't get the flu shot. Supposedly, once you have it, you get sick right away, and it gets worse instead of like when you get it. So I see no point of it. Either way, you're going to get sick, so might as well not get it.
Actually, not true. And a lot of people believe this. It's unfortunate. Remember that when you go out and you get the shot for the flu, remember that you're talking about a virus which is actually dead. It can't cause the influenza illness. So please, listeners, understand that if you get the vaccine, you cannot get the flu from it.
Here's Serena Delgado from Claremont, California. She's also anti-flu shot, but she stays away from the needle because...
I'm a vegetarian and I just don't... I'm not really a shot kind of person. I'm more holistic and I like organic stuff. I have a naturally high immune system because of all the antioxidants I get in my diet.
Dr. Greenfield, you buy that?
Well, you know, my field is integrative medicine, and so I am all about prevention, using diet and lifestyle to try and keep yourself healthy, and that's awesome. But you don't do those things fully to the exclusion of good conventional medical care as well. You do both of them. Eat well, manage your stress, get enough sleep, and get the vaccine.
When it comes to treating the symptoms, Echinacea or DayQuil? I mean, do you go holistic or do you go over the counter?
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that. In terms of what you can take, you know, for aches and pains and a little bit of fever, you can try things like Tylenol. For youngsters, we strongly recommend against using aspirin, however. For kids who have the flu, who have a bad viral infection, don't use aspirin because you run the risk of causing something called RISE syndrome, which can be very dangerous. But the best way to go about this, bed rest, listen to what mom said, push fluids, get plenty of sleep and rest.
Do I have to lean towards the name brand stuff, or can I be a cheapskate like me and go for generic?
Actually, as long as you know that the manufacturer can be trustworthy, then you can go ahead and move forward with the less expensive one.
All right, and during an ugly flu season, even if you're taking good care of yourself, it's hard to avoid those who may not be. For example, here's Marie Bolden from Pomona, California.
I take off. If I'm sick, you know, I don't want to get other people sick, so I don't go to work. For about a day or two. I don't think it's been more than 3 days.
Now, that sounds all well and good, Dr. Greenfield, but I know a lot of managers and employers who do not like seeing people being AWOL.
It's really true, but I tell you what, hats off to Marie because she's making the right choice. You know, you take a look and see, it's irresponsible, honestly, to go to work, and the managers need to understand this. Again, you know, this is the kind of thing that can not only cause people to get very sick, but it's killing people. And unfortunately, a significant number of people who have died already this year are young children. So if you're sick, stay home.
If you've got to go to work, what advice do you give?
Well, if you got to go to work, there's a few things. One is actually try and stay away from your coworkers as much as possible. If you do sneeze or cough, try and do so into a handkerchief or a tissue and then immediately wash your hands. If you don't have a tissue or a handkerchief nearby, I know this sounds like a crazy recommendation, but everybody's saying it, sneeze into your sleeve and then immediately go wash up again. If you are a person around somebody who's sick, make sure you're washing your hands frequently. And if you can't get near a sink and soap and things like that, you can use some of these alcohol-based gels. They really can make a difference.
Dr. Russell Greenfield is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Dr. Greenfield, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Everybody, be well.
Could vitamin D help protect against the flu? Dr. Greenfield weighs in at our website, marketplace.org. Okay, incredible as it may seem, many of the 230,000 cars marinated in the inky floodwaters of Hurricane Sandy are now being bought and sold. The vehicles may be salvaged for spare parts or end up with people looking for a bargain basement deal. But some unscrupulous owners are engaging in what's called title washing. That's altering a car's paperwork to disguise the damage and then resell it to unwitting customers. Sally Herships went shopping for tips on how to avoid a Hurricane Sandy lemon.
Buying a used car is complicated enough without having to worry about disguised damage from a hurricane. Imagine, if you will, the following scenario.
Is this the car?
Oh, yes, it is. This is the car that got me through college. It's a great car.
Are this plane's from Jersey? I thought you said you were from Texas. So the car is from Jersey?
By way of Texas.
This is definitely a car to be suspicious of.
Phil Reed is senior consumer advice editor for auto website Edmunds.com. He says a car from an eastern seaboard state that's been moved shortly after Sandy is a big red flag.
There are a number of other signs that will definitely trigger suspicion, and one would be headlights that had condensation on the inside, headlights, taillights.
Then there's the smell. Nothing says hurricane damage like eau de mildew.
Aside from the odor, you can look at things like peel up the carpeting in the trunk, any place where water could have collected. And if you see mud or dirt, that's a sign.
That's Frank Scafidi with the National Insurance Crime Bureau. But you should be equally suspicious if there's no dirt under the hood. A little oil residue on the engine is normal.
Wow, that is, I've never seen a used car so with such a clean engine.
Well, you know, I like to treat this car like it's my own child, you know, but better.
Experts say a mechanic can tell you if someone is trying to hide saltwater damage. But the first thing you should do, says Reed, before you take a trip to look at a car, is run a vehicle history report from a site like Carfax. The site has a mascot, the car Fox, who will tell you in a little cartoon bubble on the screen if records of flood damage were removed. If it does raise red flags, Reed says, don't waste your time.
Oh, so the trunk, it looks like there's a lot of room back here. Let me just... Hey, is that water?
Just a little rainwater.
Smells fishy to me. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You can drive through a list of tips on avoiding a lemon, a sour sandy lemon that is, on our website. That's marketplace.org.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Time now for the latest in our occasional essay series that commentator Judy Muller calls Senior Moments. It's Judy's look at the economics of the baby boom generation, and that includes herself.
I've never been crazy about the term bucket list, probably because it's a reminder of the fact that I will eventually kick said bucket. Even so, I find myself compiling a list of places I hope to see before it's too late, a mental exercise I chalk up to peer pressure. My peers, being baby boomers, seem to be competing for the most notches on their bucket list belt. There they are on Facebook and holiday cards, posing with penguins in Antarctica, grinning or perhaps grimacing from the heights of Machu Picchu and Kilimanjaro. It all feels a bit manic. Explored the Galapagos? Check. Safari in Tanzania? Check. Cycling in Cambodia? Check. I haven't done any of these things, so I admit to a certain amount of bucket list envy. It takes a combination of time and money to pull this off, and the adventure travel industry is wisely targeting those seniors who have both. Boomers are also spending big bucks on other kinds of trips. Eco-travel for the environmentally conscious. Voluntourism for those who want to help indigenous communities. Religious pilgrimages. And medical tourism, a $60 billion industry that invites people to get tummies tucked or hips replaced in a less expensive country. And hey, you can take in the sights while you're recuperating. The most popular medical destinations include Singapore, Thailand, Costa Rica, and Mexico. Of course, a lot of boomers, even those in their 60s, still have to work for a living. Bucket list travel for those people may seem as remote as retirement itself. My advice? Start small. When I told my daughter I'd like to take her somewhere for her 40th birthday this year, she responded, "Let's go to surf camp." I'm not sure I can resurrect my old surfing skills, much less my old surfing muscles, but in a moment of nostalgia and bucket list mania, I said yes. I'm thinking Costa Rica or Mexico. You know, one of those countries offering cheap knee replacements.
Judy Muller teaches journalism at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. What makes you wealthy? Is it the amount you earn, whether you own a home debt-free, or that you can send your kids to college without thinking about loans? Our reporters are visiting cities across the country to ask people to finish this sentence. You know you're wealthy when... Here's some of what you said in our nation's capital.
You know you're wealthy when they ask you for your home phone number and you have to ask which one.
You're able to do something that you love without having to pay the bills.
When you are happy and you're able to share that happiness freely.
You don't have to do any of your daily responsibilities. Like you don't have to drive yourself to work or do your dishes or prepare your meals.
You know you're wealthy when you don't have to worry about today or tomorrow, next week, next year, or any time in your lifetime about running out of money or not being able to manage financially.
Jason Slotkin produced that piece for us with photography from Alexander Heilner. You can check out the project online at marketplace.org. And we'd like to know how you would finish that sentence. You know you're wealthy when... Fill in the blank on Facebook or on Twitter at Marketplace APM. You know, if there's anything the Money Crew cares about, it's helping you be the best manager of your moolah that you possibly can be. And that's why we like to pass the microphone each week to all of our peeps out in radio land to bring you into the show. A money peep. That's like, what, a meep? That sounds like something the Roadrunner would say.
Meep, meep.
Yeah, like that. Okay, anyway, let's move on. Our first caller is Jamie calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
So what's your question, Jamie?
Well, I'm in a bit of a pickle ethically here. Consider me a new investor, and I'm in the process of opening a Roth IRA. And I keep getting sent these mutual fund options from my investment advisor. But, you know, in that bundle of investments in the mutual fund, each fund has at least a handful of companies that I, you know, in my personal day-to-day life kind of actively avoid. And I'm curious if there's any way that I can avoid these companies, you know, with my investments as well.
Jamie, what you're talking about here is what's known as socially responsible investing. In other words, you want to put your money into companies that you believe in and some mm-hmm. that you might not. For example, if you're a non-smoker, you might not want to put your money in with the tobacco industry. You might not want to put your money in with a defense company. You might not want to put your money in with a company that's into nuclear energy. I mean, am I getting it right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm facing. thing here.
Yeah, and there's an entire cottage industry that has sprung up to address this. And historically, so-called SRI funds, socially responsible investing funds, they sort of lagged the broader market, the S&P 500, because they didn't really have the diversity of investments to weather the storm. So you slept better at night, but you didn't quite get a better return. I'm here to say, though, that's kind of changed a little bit. A lot of these funds have grown more diverse over time. They don't have the breadth of the S&P 500, but they might have 100, 200, maybe even 300 companies that you can live with a little bit. And so the returns increasingly are matching the S&P 500. So you kind of get the best of all worlds. And in this case, now it just becomes a matter of finding the fund that you like. Are there any particular industries you would like to avoid?
Oil, like big oil companies, the big day-to-day living type companies that do a lot of testing on animals.
Okay.
Personally, I don't buy those products, you know, for ethical reasons. And, you know, I'm a little unnerved when I see those are the only options in the mutual funds that I'm getting from my advisor. So,
and in a sense, Jamie, you're doing exactly what Warren Buffett would tell you to do, and that is buy companies whose products you use. I've always thought that made a lot of sense. It made me feel like my money was going into something that I actually understood. And I think that's important as an investor. But that said, you do want to maximize your investments. And we live in a complicated world. So, for example, you might not want to invest in an Exxon or a Chevron. On the other hand, those companies do put money into solar power, wind power, alternative energy, albeit maybe not as much as you'd like, but they do that. And so it becomes a little trickier now when you try and parse your investments, because are you denying those funds to those companies for the purposes that you like? Moreover, are you denying your portfolio access to the potential returns that a broader investment can give you? That's where SRI investing becomes a little tricky. So here's what I'm going to tell you to do. Go on to Google. Do a search for socially responsible investing. You're going to find a whole bunch of sites that'll come up, including some nonprofits that actually have great tools for comparing different SRI funds to show you not just what's in them, but also their returns on an annual basis so you can make an informed decision. I would advise you to be just a little open-minded about some of these companies, because even though they do things on the one hand you might not like, they might also be doing things on the other hand that you do. So do your homework. You buy that?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right, Jamie, do some good. Thank you very much for calling.
Thanks.
Our next question is coming from Tristan in San Francisco, my old stomping grounds. Hi, Tristan.
Hi, how you doing?
Very good, thank you. So how are things in the Bay Area?
So far, so good.
What do you do?
I'm a teacher here at a public school.
I have so much respect for teachers who just, you know, they go the extra mile, even when the whole system is conspiring to make it hard. So
that's how it feels sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, big props. All right, Tristan, what's your question?
When I started teaching about 6 years ago, I set up a 403B plan and started making deductions, and I haven't really thought about it a lot since. And then recently I got a letter from my school district saying that they were going to start instituting or whatever company they use to administrate it is going to start a monthly fee of $3 for anybody that's doing the salary deduction. I'm only contributing about $250 a month to that. So it's effectively like a 1% fee on the money that's going into that. So my question is this a time that I need to go find another provider, or is that small enough that it's not going to make a big chunk? And I'm just sort of fearful of having to go out and wade through prospectuses again.
That's a good question. You're not alone. First of all, that's a fine how do you do, isn't it? When they impose a management fee on your retirement fund. And for everybody playing along at home, basically what this is, it's a managed fund. They've got some guy or some woman who's calling the shots, quarterbacking the fund, moving in and out of different stocks. Okay, I get that. And since it's a retirement fund, you don't want to be locked into any one thing, perhaps. You want to keep your portfolio a little more nimble. On the other hand, management fees add up so quick, and it's just the easiest way to put a hole in your pocket when it comes to your retirement planning, because you're paying the salary of this person. And the dirty little secret of the investing world is that most managed funds do not outperform the index funds like the S&P 500. So it kind of raises a big question about, are you getting your money's worth? And my question for you, Tristan, is, do you have a choice? Does your provider give you the option of getting into a different fund, or are you locked into this one?
What I have a choice of is to move to a different provider than TIAA Crest. The fee is being paid by some providers that the district works with, instead of their individual investors paying that. So I have the option of, starting a fund with a separate provider and possibly rolling over if I'd like to.
So right now, as a teacher, TIAA Cref is clearly, you know, the home team. I mean, that's who you've been dealing with all along. If you go to a different fund provider, severing your tie with TIAA Cref, what does that do to you?
There's no rollover fee.
Okay.
So I can do that pretty easily. It's mainly the thing I'm fearful of is the headache of trying to find somebody that... And doing my homework, you know.
All right. Well, homework should never be a deterrent, and that applies to you and to everybody. If you want to be a smart steward of your money, you got to do the homework. Otherwise, you're always going to be behind the eight ball. You're never going to be on top of your game. I mean, think of the big money guys out there on Wall Street. They're just not sitting back and waiting for the profits to roll in. They're out there every day going over the paperwork, crunching the numbers, trying to stay ahead of the curve. Now, you don't have to work that hard. But you do need to be on top of your money, and there's one big reason for that. It's your money. If you don't do it, nobody will. There's so many tools online, whether you're going with Fidelity or Vanguard or Schwab or anybody. They've all got websites that are like Swiss Army knives at this point. They've got everything you could possibly want out there except a magnifying glass. And on top of that, by rolling up your sleeves and looking at how the funds are doing, you're going to become smarter about how your money's performing. So when you have to make changes, you're not going to be so surprised. So that shouldn't be a deterrent. My feeling in your situation is, if there's no downside whatsoever to moving away from the current fund provider and go finding another one, then I would say do it, because management fees, it's just money down the drain. I mean, yeah, some of those fees are justified, but at 1.5%, you could probably do better, let's face it. And that's your retirement you're playing with, quite simply.
All right. That gives me some courage to go out there and do that research.
Good. And courage is exactly what's needed frequently when we have to make these tough calls. And it's not hard. And that's really what I want to emphasize to everybody. It sounds difficult. It sounds like you've got to be Bill Gates or Warren Buffett to do this stuff. You don't. So, Tristan, thank you so much for the call.
Great. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Let's move on. Our next caller is Carol, calling from right here in L.A. Hi, Carol.
Hi, David.
Hi. So what do you do?
Well, I am an independent filmmaker and a freelance contract attorney, and I'm segueing out of freelance contract attorney, which is part of why I'm calling today.
Okay, hang on. I got to dial that one back a little bit. You're an independent filmmaker and a contract attorney.
Yes.
So you went through all the hassle of law school, got out of law school, and said, you know what I want to do? I want to make films.
Well, you know, I wish you had been around when I was walking in the doors of the law school. For 20 years, I've been trying to make the legal career work, and my heart's not in it, and it's not working out, so it's time to move on.
So, Allie McBeal, you're not.
No.
All right. So, it is time to move on. All right. So, what can we do to help?
Well, on paper, I qualify to file for bankruptcy. In fact, I have qualified since I got laid off. I wasn't always a contract attorney, but I got laid off at the beginning of the recession. And you know, the recession was very, very bad for a long time in California. I've been fighting filing for bankruptcy because it's just not something I'm comfortable with. But now that I have to rework my legal career, and I can go into doing some admin work in the legal field, and I have good skills, so I'm pretty sure that I can get a position, but I'm probably looking at a smaller salary, which means I may not have any choice anymore about whether to declare bankruptcy. But my question for you is, at what point does fighting off bankruptcy become really foolish as opposed to being something noble?
So you're basically picking the high road here. You want to be honorable. You want to meet your obligations. And you see bankruptcy as a shirking of that.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Your first thing you've got to think about is the stigma of bankruptcy, which may be applied during the Bailey Building and Loan era, isn't really a going concern anymore. I mean, it's almost a fashion trend at this point. After this economy, people are doing it. The whole idea of a bankruptcy isn't to punish you. The idea of a bankruptcy is to give you a second chance. That's what the system is about. So any stigma that you feel is attached to it, just throw that out the window. Now, this idea that you want to be a good, upstanding citizen and meet your obligations, that's great. That's terrific. But at some point, you got to cut your losses, even if you didn't during law school. So what I would say is, okay, then at some point, when it makes the most fiscal sense, that's what you got to do. Carol, here's what I think your most important concern is. How are you doing for retirement? Are you planning?
I knew you were going to get to that. No. No, and I'm in my early 50s, and that's my big concern is I have no plans for retirement. And I listen to the program regularly, and I hear that it's not a lost cause at my age, but that's actually kind of why I called to get some moral support, because I think that that's one of the big reasons why I have to make to go forward with this and stop thinking of the stigma like you're talking about.
Consider yourself morally supported. The retirement plan is the big dog in your life, especially if you're over the seeming halfway mark and you're into your 50s now. You need to be focused on this. If a bankruptcy clears the deck and helps you start allocating funds for that, great. Now, obviously, bankruptcy, you know, there's some hits. Your credit score is going to get smacked upside the head. You're going to become persona non grata with creditors for a while, but you'll work through that. Here's my advice. Go look into what's known as SEP IRAs, S-E-P IRAs. These are retirement funds, and they are perfect for freelancers like yourself. They will allow you to put in money up to a cap of $50,000 a year or so. And I'm guessing you don't have $50,000 to put in on an annual basis, so that's not going to be an issue. And you'll be able to start making some tax-free investments in your future, and that's exactly where you want to be. You feel morally supported now?
I do.
All right, Carol, I wish you the best of luck. Keep your eye on the bigger picture, and that'll get you through this, okay?
Thanks, David.
All right, thank you for calling in. That's about all the time we've got now for all of you meeps out there. Yeah, that's our money peeps, new term that I'm coining. If you have any questions, it is easy to get in touch with us. All you got to do is go to marketplace.org and submit your letter. That's also a place where you can comment on the show as much as your heart content. So if you've got better advice than I have, and you just might, feel free to chime in yourself at marketplace.org. As a type 1 diabetic, I know firsthand that technology plays a huge role in managing a chronic disease. And it seems like there's always some new app or gadget aimed at making the job easier. You might remember last week when Marketplace technology reporter Queena Kim sent us an audio postcard from CES. That's the big consumer electronics show. Well, she's back to talk about some of the healthcare-related devices that she saw there. Hiya, Queena.
Hey, David.
Okay, so when I think about consumer electronics, I'm thinking TVs, video games, cell phones. But apparently healthcare is a big deal now.
Yeah, it's a huge emerging market. And in CES, they had this huge exhibit hall filled with them. Gadgets for almost everything, how you sleep, how many steps you take. There's even a gadget to tell whether your mole is cancerous. So I met up with Nick Martin. He's the head of innovation and research at United Healthcare. That's the insurance company. And he took me on a tour. One of the things United Healthcare is interested in is combating obesity, which, as you know, is a big problem in America.
Obesity is an absolute epidemic throughout the country, and it's contributing to diabetes. You know, if you can lose 7% of your body weight, if you are pre-diabetic, you can prevent diabetes from occurring. And wireless scales and activity monitors can really help you reach that goal.
Here we are at the Fitbit booth, and You're talking about this scale here?
Scale, yep, that's the Fitbit Aria wireless scale.
It's a sleek black Wi-Fi smart scale. You step on it, and then what happens?
So what's special about the scale is it's Wi-Fi enabled. That means that this device is connected to an individual's Wi-Fi network at home, and then you can engage in challenges. So if I had a challenge with you, maybe to lose 5 pounds, we could get on that scale every single day, and that data would automatically go into our challenges system, and then you and I could banter back and forth and engage in a challenge.
And do we know how much this costs?
I don't know the answer to that.
Hey, do you work with Fitbit?
I certainly do.
Can you tell me how much a scale costs?
The Aria Wi-Fi scales cost $129 in the US, and it'll also give you your body fat percentage as well.
How does that technology work?
When you stand on them, there's 4 sensors on the scales, and if you get on with bare feet, it sends a little signal. You won't feel it through your body, and it can actually measure your body fat composition.
Let me take you over to Telcare. The Telcare organization has a wireless blood glucose meter.
So here we are at the booth, and it looks like an older cell phone.
It does.
So what does this device do?
A diabetic has to take their blood glucose multiple times a day. If you can wirelessly transmit that data to the cloud and help people manage their overall diabetic condition, you can really help them live more independently.
And how much does a device like this cost?
Telcare device comes in around $100.
Nick Martin, Vice President of Innovation, Research, and Development at United Healthcare, thanks for coming on the Marketplace.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I often said the big problem with home scales is they're just not Wi-Fi enabled. So good to see that coming around. So, Queen Akim, it sounds as though data is the big thing going forward, and there's going to be a lot of sharing, a lot of interactivity when it comes to keeping yourself fit.
Yeah, and the idea right now, big data is sort of a theme in tech in general. And it seems that all the techies think that if you give, they give you more and more data about your health, you know, how you sleep, how many steps you take, what your blood pressure is, that you will be able to track this data, make some sense of it, and make yourself healthier.
All right. Marketplace's Queen Akim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm as cheap as the next guy, but I know there are times when you do need to splurge, particularly when it comes to entertaining. Whether it be spending $45 million on an inaugural do, which will be the case on Monday, or thousands of dollars on a birthday party. Hispanic girls take their first steps into adulthood at an occasion called the quinceañera. It's less a birthday party and more a rite of passage, which means money is frequently no object. Vanessa Romo reports on one particular budget battle that goes on in Latino families all over America.
Even on a crowded dance floor where everyone's pretending to ride an invisible pony, it only takes a few seconds to spot the birthday girl. Cassandra Austin is practically floating on a frothy cloud of yellow tulle and sparkling sequins.
When I saw the dress, I felt like, oh my gosh, I look like Belle from Beauty and the Beast.
This party at the Green River Golf Course in Corona is a quinceañera, a 15th birthday celebration for Latinas. This is similar to a debutante ball or a bar mitzvah. It's a rite of passage from girlhood to, well, young ladyhood. That transition includes a formal dinner, a waltz, a DJ, a photo booth, a cupcake table, a candy spread, and a light setup worthy of Studio 54. What did it all cost? Here's Cassandra's mom, Marcella.
Seriously, with all the decorations and everything, I would say maybe between $13,000 to $15,000.
$15,000 for a party of about 100 guests?
Yeah, I would say about 15.
I would say 15.
She says their original budget was set at $9,000, though Cassandra's dad had a different number in mind.
Ideally, I was thinking $5,000. I was hoping $5,000.
Even though they could afford it, their combined income exceeds $130,000 a year, the final bill still caused a bit of strife in the family. The struggle over what's the right amount of money to spend on a coming-of-age party is common, as an informal survey of the guests reveals. Here's Laura and Cynthia.
It was very difficult, I know, for my parents, because my dad was the only one working. I mean, can you actually believe that my parents spent more on my quinceañera than on my college education? When you talk about college, they're like, community college.
I don't put all the focus on a quinceañera.
Luis Barajas has helped Latino families plan for the one-night events for decades. As a financial advisor, he has a go-to move.
One of the things that I love to do is when I'm guiding a family is I sit down and I'll take a look at what I call life-defining moments.
These can be anything from getting a first car, getting married, or buying a first home. And when you look at these in perspective, he says, suddenly a quinceañera doesn't seem as important anymore. And usually that helps keep parents within budget. When you don't do that, Baraja says, you get the horror stories. Wives taking their wedding rings to pawn shops and never going back for them, refinancing a home, or...
Here's the worst case scenario, taking money out from a 401k that they have. And again, if they do have, they don't have a lot of money in the retirement plan, but they borrow from their 401k to use the money for the quinceañera, and they can't afford to pay it back. Eventually, it gets up being penalized, and they have to pay taxes on it.
Cassandra's parents, Marcela and Fernando, did go over budget. Though they didn't cash out their retirement accounts, they did put $6,000 on the family credit card. The debate in their house is particularly drawn out because the quinceañera tradition only comes from one side of the family. Marcela is Mexican-American and had her own quinceañera in the mid-80s. Fernando is African-American, and he thought the splendor of it was indulgent.
And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, in my mind, I was like, there's no way, you know, that we're going to do this. You know, no, that's too much, way too much.
Here's Fernando's mom, Sally.
In the black culture, we didn't do that. We might have done a 16th birthday party, but not anything like this.
Sally and her husband, Chauncey, still aren't convinced it's a worthwhile expense.
When I came here and they were going through the plans and everything, I said, this is going to get a little on the expensive side. First thing I said, I don't have any money.
Despite their misgivings, they admit it's a beautiful party, and their granddaughter does look like a Disney princess in the $150 poofy dress they paid for. At the end of the night, Cassandra and her parents pose for a family photo. A perfect shot, says her mom, on a perfect night. And to heck with the expense.
What I would say to people who think we're crazy, like I always said from the beginning, it was just tradition. Regardless whether it was going to be a backyard party or a party like this, it's just tradition. You have to have a quinceañera.
In Los Angeles, I'm Vanessa Romo for Marketplace.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. When President Obama takes the oath of office Monday, he'll stand at the center of a region with some of the greatest income inequality in the country. But in Washington, many of the rich and poor have something in common. Their income depends in some way on the federal government. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Kate Davidson has three stories of how looming budget cuts in D.C. are reverberating across the classes.
Let's start right at the foot of the Capitol. You can't get much closer than here in the office of this lobbyist.
I can sit at my desk, which was made in Montana, and feel like I'm in the wilderness, and then I can look out the window and see the United States Capitol and the United States Senate, and I feel just great.
Bob Van Heuvelen used to work in the Senate. Now he lobbies it on behalf of biofuel and healthcare companies, and that brings in a lot of money.
I'm lucky to be one of those people who will now have to pay a little bit more tax. I'm happy to step up.
I asked Van Heuvelen how someone like him, who makes money requesting things from the government, reacts to the possibility it will shrink. Turns out he's not worried about his own pockets. He worries for people like his 93-year-old father, who just spent 2 weeks in intensive care with a bad flu.
These remarkable doctors and nurses rescued him. He had an incredibly low blood pressure, and they pulled him out of it.
Then he went to a nursing home, which will be partly covered by Medicare. It's the safety net this Washington lobbyist thinks of when he looks at budget battles coming down the road.
You know, and what would I do if Medicare weren't there? And I'm a person who's fortunate. What if people who don't have anything to their name, what do they do in this circumstance? I don't know what they do.
Hi, Larry.
You don't have to go far from the Capitol, just a few miles across the Anacostia River, to reach the other end of the income scale. Natasha Alston lost her job after she had her daughter a couple years ago. They both wound up homeless.
It's devastating, it is, but at the same time, you don't want to stay in that position. I could not sit back and continue to cry about what happened. I had to get up and do something about it because I had a child.
Today, Alston lives in supported housing while studying to be a certified nursing assistant. Every dollar counts in the transition from homelessness. Sitting right there on her counter is an example of how federal spending cuts could make that math harder. It's a can of baby formula.
And this is for sensitive tummies and soy infants. So this is powder. Powder is much easier for us, just to shake and go.
Each can of formula costs about $28. Alston gets 9 cans a month for her baby boy through the supplemental nutrition program known as WIC. WIC is one of the federal programs that could face cuts under sequestration. Those sweeping cuts to defense and discretionary spending are still on the calendar, unless Congress comes up with an alternative. Alston hopes she won't have to take milk money out of another supplement, like food stamps.
You know, it would take a huge chunk out of it, wherein we would suffer as well.
In the defense world, the threat of a $52 billion cut this year has mobilized the Pentagon and shaken the web of defense contractors fanning out across the suburbs. Jim Jeans is one thread of that web. He's an aerospace structural engineer in Herndon, Virginia, and he's our last stop.
The first big job I did was the B-2, this thing.
The stealth bomber, super secret back in the 80s.
It was secret, special access required. I couldn't even tell anybody what I was working on.
Back then, he worked for the big contractors. Now he runs his own small business. He's always had work. He lives in a big house, though he jokes none of the recent tax hike proposals would have affected him. Most of his government work comes from NASA, and he thinks space is safe. But defense cuts make him...
Well, worry. I don't know how any budget changes are going to impact me. I know many of my customers are very worried and have scaled back what they're doing.
The thing is, Jeans is a pretty conservative guy. He's the first to say government should shrink, all of it. But he also believes in his clients. Take space.
We should want to expand as a race and investigate what's out there. That, to me, is valid expense. And the other is military. I mean, that's in our Constitution that we should be protecting ourselves. So the part of the government that I support, it, to me, is a very valid part of the government.
Jim Jeans is trying to diversify his client base. He mentions dredges and race cars. He'll find work, whatever happens, because he loves it and because he's skeptical Social Security will survive the budget chopping block long enough for his retirement. In Washington, I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
And all next week, our friends at Marketplace Morning Report are broadcasting from member station WLRN in Miami. As President Obama embarks on his second term, the morning crew will be reporting on what we're calling the new American dream. A few months ago, we teamed up with a group of journalism students at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School. We used social media to track down people who were born on past inauguration days so we could ask them how they think America has changed since they came into the world.
I'm Robert Olin Butler. I'm a novelist, short story writer, and I was born actually on the day that Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated for the last time.
My name is Kira McDonough, and this is my son, Ronan Godo.
Hi.
And Ronan is 3 years old and is going to be turning 4 on January 20th.
I'm Larry Sequino. I'm 23, and I live in Santa Monica. I was born on the inauguration day for George H.W. Bush.
Being born on inauguration day has felt to me all my life like as if I were born on the 4th of July, a celebration of the hopefulness of a new president.
When we arrived at the hospital and they set me up in my room, I went ahead and we turned on the inauguration, and I was in active labor and watching it.
I went to George W. Bush's second inauguration, so it was like on my 16th birthday. It was through a student group, and then they threw like an inaugural ball afterwards for us, and everyone like sang me happy birthday, so it was really awesome.
Ronan actually came out when the Star Spangled Banner was playing in the room, so we kind of consider it his birth song.
The happenstance of my birthday has really influenced my work in some basic ways. My Pulitzer Prize book was called A Good Send from a Strange Mountain. It was really about all the Vietnamese who came to the United States. And that reassessment of self to become somebody that you were not before in a new land, it was a way for me to see who we are as Americans.
What was a challenge for us was shortly after I found out that I was pregnant, my husband found out that he lost his job, which meant we lost our health care coverage. We had to then pay for COBRA, which cost at least $1,000 a month, if not slightly more.
It was kind of a good time to be born, especially like my dad being a software salesman during the dot-com boom. That's how I ended up in computer science. And everyone needs computer programmers these days. Some of my friends that don't know the computer side of things, I try and convince, like, why don't you just learn computer science? Like, you'll get a job really easily.
Currently, we lose sight of the proportion of things. My own childhood was very much filled with the awareness of the Great Depression. And my own emotions are that we will get through all of this. And I'm continuing to do my part and buy lots of things as a reflection of that.
Hey, Ronan, what do you want to be when you grow up?
When I grow up, I want to be a football player.
Too cute. We've got more coverage on the inauguration, including profiles of people born on Inauguration Day, a timeline of notable firsts in inauguration history, collect them all, and a series of essays from authors like Jeffrey Eugenides. It's all at marketplace.org. Nearly a million people are in D.C. this weekend for the president's Off We Go Again Wing Ding. That's a lot of mouths to feed and a lot of souvenirs to sell. We sent Marketplace's Jason Slotkin out on the streets of the Capitol to see which tchotchkes are hot.
I'm Charlene Kramer, and I live in Washington, D.C., and I'm retired from Fannie Mae. Yeah, I'm buying an Obama bobblehead and some T-shirts. Bobbleheads absolutely are uniquely American. And as a matter of fact, with the first inauguration for Obama, we bought a number of them and sent them to friends in France and Mexico and in other countries. And they were just could not believe that we had something like a bobblehead of our president.
John Palmer, retired NBC News correspondent. I just bought a couple of champagne flutes with the presidential seal on it. We have some friends coming in from Boston, and they're going to be staying with us for 3 days because the hotel rooms, I guess, are hard to get, and they're very expensive when you can get them. So we thought we'd put this in the room with a nice bottle of champagne to welcome them for the inauguration of the president and Joe Biden.
Hi, I'm Eileen Johnson. I live in Washington, D.C. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I'm a writer. I'm working on a children's book. Right now I have a bunch of buttons that I'm definitely going to buy. This is one of my favorites. It's a picture of a group with their arms waving. They look like they're dancing. It says Californians for Obama, and that just makes me smile, so I want to buy that. And when I saw this button, I thought, where's the medical marijuana dispensary? Is it nearby where they took this picture on this button?
My name is Freddy Vinoya. I'm one of the manager of Honest Abe's Souvenir in D.C., we got all the inauguration stuff here. So this one is like a new item. So, I mean, it's hottest. I mean, so far it's good selling. If you see the package, it says the ultimate stimulus package, Obama condoms for hard times. It's kind of like won't break as easily as his promises say it with the condom. I mean, so we are selling for $3.99 each, three for $10.
Yes. Oh, wow. What size are those? I'm Rosemary Blake, and I'm from Cape Town, South Africa, and I'm in D.C. working. I bought an NCIS shirt for my dad, and I bought one that's another inauguration shirt that's got, like, Barack Obama's face big on it, and a more sort of stylistic one, kind of like a coat of arms thing. And I don't know if I'll be back in D.C. again, so it's kind of cool to have been here at a special time because it also is temporal, so it's like I was there and I was there then.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplace.org, or you can get in touch on our Facebook page, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, online funerals are gaining popularity, but not everyone is on board with a virtual memorial service.
My family, they did not want to have that
I think they thought it might have been intrusive, but they originally did not want to do it, and I did. I thought it was a good idea. And we got wonderful letters from people who saw it live. Even one of my dad's elderly friends figured out how to do it and watched it live.
Marketplace Money is produced by President Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Parinata. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. Executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. Marketplace general manager is J.J. York. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.